thank you all for coming. And it's a great pleasure and honor to introduce Dušan Bjelić, our guest from University of Southern Maine. He got his both MA and BA in sociology from the University of Belgrade. He earned his PhD in sociology from Boston University in 1989, and he joined the University of Southern Maine faculty in 1990, where he's a professor of criminology. He has taught sociology at the University of Belgrade, Boston University, Tufts, Bentley, and Emerson College. His areas of interest are ethnomethodology, Balkan studies, critical studies of psychoanalysis, and psychiatry. Professor Bjelić co-edited the book Balkan as a Metaphor Between Globalization and Fragmentation, which I think his talk will be based on today. His other book, Galileo's Pendulum, Science, Sexuality, and the Body, Instrumental Link, Body-Instrument Link, was published by the SUNY Press in 2003. Normalizing the Balkans, Geopolitics of Psychiatry and Psychoanalysis was published by Ashgate in 2011. And his book is forthcoming in 2017 on Freud and cocaine. Very interesting. Okay, so without much further ado, here is okay. Professor Bjelić.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to come and talk to you on this topic. This is my second occasion, as was mentioned, when it was 20 years after the starting of war in the Balkans. Mm-hmm. There was a topic. I would like to start off with just a personal intro to this topic. It's like I am a Balkan scholar by default. It was not my intent to study Balkans, even less Yugoslavia. In fact, I left Yugoslavia and came here because I didn't want to do anything with Yugoslavia. And what I wanted to study is what is called ethnomethodology, which probably many of you haven't heard of it, or if you did, might have a wrong understanding of it, because it has nothing to do with ethnicity. It's just it was a very peculiar heretical discipline within American sociology that only few people knew about it. And this is what I wanted to study. In other words, something that is so far away from my Yugoslav identity. Until war started, and when the war started, then I felt that regardless of what I wanted to be and what my political position was, I was dragged into this discourse by which my Serbian identity, and again, I am Serb by default, because I was identified with Yugoslav identity. I mean, I was born in Yugoslavia, that's a country that I knew, and Serbia was not something that I identify with. Nonetheless, that was the important part by which I was being recognized in the public as well as among my colleagues, unfortunately. So it was a really tough time in the 90s. I wouldn't say it for us was as much as it is today for being a Muslim. Obviously, that is far more difficult and longer. But it was there were a couple of years that was really problematic to be recognized as a Serb. And so there was a editor from MIT Press who lived in outside of Portland heard about me and thought that I am specialist in the field, and he came to me and said, why don't you write a book about the Balkans? And this is the first time that I was solicited to focus on something that I actually didn't know. I just experienced on a personal level. And so anyway, to make a long story short, I accepted that proposal, and after a few years, the book was published, Balkan as Metaphor Between Globalization and Fragmentation, which is a collection of essays, including Toma, being in on the Balkan scholars' response to the Western representation of the Balkans. So it was something like a Balkan version of Said's Orientalism, you know, to identify mechanisms by which Balkan is being represented in a particular predictable cliché way. And then we were unpacking the gap between how Balkan is being represented and what actually Balkan reality is. Anyway, what what I found through this engagement with this topic, not what I had to really move from focusing on sociology of science to now Balkan studies. And of course, as a member of this culture, I knew things as a native of the area. But I never really reflected about it, never thought about what does that mean in a global context. And it's very interesting that actually from here, looking back to that place, that actually some things are becoming more and more clear to me that I couldn't understand being there, like being native. So there's this distance, critical distance, that allowed me to look things in a way in which I never knew what the Balkan really is, other than what my immediate experience of it was. And what I found out is that the Balkans, to my surprise, is actually a kind of geopolitical paradox, very unique geopolitical phenomenon that can be defined of being in and also being out at the same time of Europe. So physically, Balkan is in Europe. No, nobody denies this. But at the same time, Balkan is not in the Europe, right? Which means that there are internal borders in the Europe by which some Europeans are excluded from Europe. So today, of course, we have a couple of states such as Romania, Bulgaria, Greece being members of European Union, Croatia and Slovenia, but they're still countries that are left out precisely because they're not Europeans enough to be in Europe even though they are in Europe. So there's this kind of internal exile. Balkans were in exile while being at home. Exile from their European origin while being in Europe. And so the question was, how was this paradox created? And to what extent this paradox is still relevant and part of the Balkan reality? And this is what I call a discourse or discursive geography, that throughout history, certain form of representation of the area, as well as areas its own representation and understanding, produces a kind of complex of concepts and relationship that are specific to this area. But not only that they're specific to this area, but it's also that the meaning of this concept have a certain physical domain, that only within a certain space, physically speaking space, that this concept can be understood. Beyond that has no meaning. That is to say that concepts are not universal. They don't mean the same thing at any point on this planet. They change. Even gravity force is not everywhere at every point the same. There are variations. So you can imagine the concept even less are contain the same meaning. But in the case of the Balkans, is that the certain concepts in which you can mark the actually physical space within which this concept can circulate and be understood as such. So one of the most common one that I like to use is the question when you ask, where does the Balkan begin, right? Of course, there are two theories. One is proposed by Slavoj Žižek, who says Balkan is always east of wherever you are. So So for the Brits, France and Europe are that's where the Balkan begins. Well, for the France begins with Germany, with German in Austria, with Austrians, with Slovenia, and so on and so forth. But in reality, actually, that is incorrect, because, you know, if you tell Parisian, like, you know, oh, did you know that you are Balkans? They will laugh, right? And if you talk to Viennese and said, you know, you are regarded that you're from the Balkans, they will laugh. But if you ask somebody in Ljubljana, which is the capital of Slovenia, are you from the Balkans? Oh, no, we are Central Europeans. Okay, so let's go east. You go to Zagreb, ask somebody from Zagreb, do you know that you are on the Balkans? No, we are not in the Balkans. We are Central Europe. Is the Balkans, that's Serbia and Macedonia around there. So you go to Serbia, oh, Serbia, no, you know. So you see how Balkan begins there, where you begin to deny that you're from the Balkans, that you have a need to say that you are not from the Balkans. Now, you're never going to have anybody in Paris say denying that they're French. They don't, you know, and even if you tell them you're not European, well, we don't care. We're French, right? They don't have a problem with who they are and where they are. Where the Balkans is our own people who are uncomfortable with the place in which they are. And so they have to deny their origin. They have to object their, what we call, maternal space. And have to redefine their space, right, in their discourse as being actually one who are not there, but they're actually part of the West. And the actual Balkan is further east of them. So this is what what in our discourse we call internal Orientalism, which means that unlike Orientalism of Said, where Orient is this fictive other, unreal, fantasy-based stereotype that has nothing to do with the actual life of the Orient, that is being developed inside Western academia for the purpose of reproducing the same set of concepts, regardless of what reality is, that internal Orientalism is that the Balkans actually take stereotypes seriously. Stereotypes coming from the West, they internalize them. And they will say two things. Yes, we are lesser than you from the West, but I also find somebody who is lesser than me, who is east of me. So you're all at once to your neighbor from the east, you're west, and to your neighbor from the west, you're east. So this east and west simultaneously are being built into one's identity. And therefore, on this set of internalized concepts, is stereotypes that we actually recognize each other. So we recognize each other as accepted internalized concepts, right? So yes, I as a Serb will accept the fact that to the Slovenes I am more barbaric, because they see me that way. And they, of course, will accept this, that they're more less civilized than we are, because we both recognize that. But then they also recognize that to the Austrians and Germans, they are to them what Serbs are to them. So you have this geography of lesser humanity that is identical with the geographic displace of the territory. It literally goes from the west to the east. And therefore, concepts and geography coincide. So the question is, what is the historic configuration of this discursive geography? Because it's not something that grew out of the soil. It was a sedimentation of history, and history, of course, in the way that Balkans are being represented today, is a history of our Ottoman legacy. This is where we lost our European innocence, is when the Balkans were lost and as the Christian population was submitted to the Islamic Empire. And it's at that point where the Balkans was geographically in Europe, but symbolically it was out. And therefore, today, and in fact, from the beginning of modernity, for the Balkans to become Europeans, they have to denounce their Ottoman legacy. They have to purify themselves from the Ottoman yoke. And of course, Ottoman yoke is everything that is perceived as a pre-modern. So now, and again, you know, I mean, we have in European nation states, you have a little bit of self-cleansing, right? So the French will have to do some little self-cleansing, and Germans and so forth. But nobody had as much as the Balkans, because you know, we have to prove to Europe that we are Christian and that we are modern. And to do that, we really have to get rid of our Ottoman legacy, that is to say, of our pre-modern past. That model of modernization that involved internal cleansing basically is a skeleton of the worst kind of conflicts that grew out of this, how will I put, demands placed upon the Balkans by the Europe, because to be modern, it means that you have to have a nation state, and the assumption was that, you know, as it was known also in a political discourse, that France as a nation is regarded as, in fact, it was this expression somewhere, French Republic, a French nation, is vagina of all nations. In other words, we all have to be like French Republic in order to be accepted as modern. But what that means is that we have to have national borders and identities that are built on these political structures. And the assumption was that what worked for a French public will also work for the Balkans. Now, of course, the problem with the Balkans is, and why it was doomed to fail, is that the borders cannot work in the Balkans much as they don't work today in Africa. Because the national borders are artificial to the Balkans because everybody is mixed. And why would you draw the national line here or there, right? Where does the Serbian ethnic space end and where does the Croatian ethnic space begin, right? You know, there's all kinds of intermediate territories which you have to fight for in order to define. But that's actually where the borders had to be established. And so once you have to establish borders, you have to identify who are your minorities, because the borders and the nation state have to be built on the ethnic majority. So whoever has ethnic majority is a constitutive agency. They basically establish a nationhood to which minorities are welcome citizens. Now, of course, we know that you know, in that kind of ethnic states, where ethnicity is the constitutive element, minorities are always minorities. They don't have the same right, even though in the letter they do, but in reality they're always excluded. They don't get positioned to power and so on and so forth. But now, of course, these minorities are basically democratic extension of their nation state. So there are Serb minorities in Croatia on the border with Serbia, just as Croatians on the border on the other side of Bosnian territories and so forth. So once you have a situation in which minorities are by constitution and law marginalized, then naturally they tend to join, to secede and join the their ethnic state. But then, of course, if you have a constitution, and constitution obliges you to maintain your sovereign borders, then you have to deal with secession. Which means that actually, paradoxically, ethnic cleansing becomes constitutional demand put on the part of the governments to preserve integrity of the national space in the case that minorities want to secede and take a piece of territory and join the neighboring ethnic state. So in other words, if you really want to establish nation state in its full with its full power as it exists in France, for example, you will have to have a war. You have to have ethnic wars. You have to have ethnic cleansing as an unavoidable consequence. And of course, when it comes to this moment, then you develop discourse. You have to justify why in the world, on the behalf of law and constitution, you will have to commit crimes against humanity. That's where the discourse on Oriental Other kicks in, which is to say that these minorities are our Ottoman yoke, right? They are ones who are who had to be cleansed in order for us to become modern nation. Not only that we are being colonized, that's a discourse by the Ottomans, we are also colonized by the Marxists, right? The Marxism was regarded as a colonial time in which ethnicity and ethnic discourse was suppressed and criminalized. And now we have liberated ourselves from communism. Now we are free to form our state, but then we realize that on those borders that we have imagined to be ours, there are all these minorities that are threatening our sovereign territory. And then, of course, come this discourse, and now probably the most notorious one was Radovan Karadžić, who was the leader of Bosnian Serbs, who was also a psychiatrist, and it was very, very interesting how much he used psychiatric discourse to combine a psychoanalytic narrative with the Orientalistic narrative, right? So that the Bosnian Muslims are the remnants of the Ottoman yoke. They are the obstacle for our modernity. And therefore, for us to become modern nation, we really have to get rid of the Ottoman yoke. So this is how this paradox, when it gets into a discourse, becomes to function as a kind of political tool, as a kind of a political force for the Balkans to destroy each other in order to join Europe as a family of modern nations. Now, in addition to ethnic wars and in addition to political wars, there's also discursive, discursive wars going on between and within the Balkan scholars. And it's mostly conflict between what is being perceived as a post-colonial approach to the Balkans versus traditional historicist approach to the Balkans. And the conflict is over the question or not whether concepts that were used in Orientalism apply to the discourse which is being named by Bulgarian historian Maria Todorova, Balkanism. So the Balkanism is something like Orientalism, that is to say, the system of stereotypical representation developed in the West, beginning of 16th, 17th century. The question is whether or not it is identical to, is the same, has the same weight as Orientalism. The argument against a post-colonial approach to Balkan studies today is grounded on the argument that Ottoman Empire was never a colonial empire in the sense of Western colonies. In other words, it was not a part of global capitalism, whereby colonialism means naked capitalism. So Ottoman Empire was empire and conquered people, but it never really developed this kind of economic capitalistic foundation. It was mostly military empire that recognized ethnic differences, had a millet system in which Jews and Christians and Muslims can live nearby each other. All they have to do pay taxes so that the Ottomans could go and conquer more land. Whereby in colonialism, you know, you have pretty much economic exploitation as the foundation of that system. So the argument then is because Balkans were never colonies and were never colonized, the post-colonial analysis doesn't apply. It's just these concepts don't fit our geography and our history, because our historic ontology deals with a very, very different historic formation. But the problem with this is that also once you eliminate post-colonial perspective, you also eliminate possibility for acknowledging the presence of, let's say, race relation or genocide. So according to Maria Todorova, genocide never happened in the Balkan history. Not even Srebrenica was not a genocide, it's just a massacre. Because we never had races. We're all white, and therefore you cannot establish a race relationship within the people who are mostly white and, all white and mostly Christian. But post-colonial argument is that actually, first of all, her understanding of race and race relationship is based on very primitive understanding of race. Basically, hidden argument is that race is still that which is being defined by racist discourse. The race is that which is the color of the skin, rather than a relational category to power, conquest, and so on and so forth. And that's why some post-colonial argument is being used on the basis of Foucault's understanding of race and race relationship that have a long-standing tradition in European political discourse that as he calls the discourse on war, race wars. The whole European history is a history of a war between races, dominant and subordinate races, and therefore race always existed on that level in the Europe, even though they were all white people, because basically society is based on superior and inferior race, not on the basis of color, but on the basis of relation to power. Secondly, in the Balkans, we all had, in the Second World War, just as in other Europe, we have a racial law. There were Jews who were being made into a race by introducing racial law. And of course, as we know, regularly being sent to concentration camps where they were being exterminated. So that is an example of race that we have history of. But the interesting argument here is somehow this is not part of our history. That's European history that is being played out in the Balkans, right? So now you have this in Europe and out of Europe acting in this direction is somehow it is their history. And also colonialism is a part of Western history, not our history, right? We become belong to different kind of history. And of course, The 90s and the ethnic cleansing and the ruling in a court of International Court of Justice that Srebrenica was a genocide is readily denied by Balkan historians on the grounds that it doesn't fit the definition of original definition of genocide, which means extermination of entire population, because in Srebrenica only male of certain age were killed, but women and children were saved, while Hitler didn't make any difference. The problem with that, of course, is that genocide is a legal definition, which means that it is just legal definitions are not definition of fixed entities. You know, they change on the basis of consensus and understanding of certain activities in a new way. You know, like in the state of Maine for a long time, courts do not recognize rape within a marriage. Today is recognized. It used to be you can, you know, slap your wife and teach her a lesson. Now this is crime. So there are things, you know, you could drive and drink and throw a bottle on the road. Now you cannot, right? So things are changing. That's what legal definitions are. And the new legal definition that is being applied in the case of Srebrenica is that a race is identical to space. If you are disconnecting a certain group of people from the space from which they live and establish the culture, you're basically exterminating them by virtue of taking a space away from them. So taking a space away from them, you're basically taking their racial identity away from them, because they're not complete without space in which they were born and lived and so on and so forth. Which brings us to the new understanding of race in the Balkan. And again, concept that is a part of discursive geography in that it has a specific application to this place and to this history. Namely, that race in the Balkans means ethnic space. So the race is not reduced to a body and physiology or biology of the body, but rather to the body's relation to a particular space. And that you can see today with this so-called immigrant crisis that all these nation states are used to defend borders, right? But what are you defending with the borders? Why are you building walls for? Unless to defend the purity of your ethnic space, right? And particularly, probably the most clear on that point is Hungary. But they said, we don't want Muslims because we are Christians. We don't want them in our space. Period. And we don't care, you know, what Merkel is going to say. And so we build the wall, which means that we are defending our space in a way in which here in the United States racial relationships are being regulated, the distance is being regulated by racial laws, you know, one drop of blood, who can inherit wealth, and so on and so forth. So there are ways in which or apartheid, right, it was also used to demarcate and to police space between the races. Where here is the race is coming from outside, other race coming from outside. That's why they see immigrants as if invasion, as if like a Turks are coming back. And therefore walls are being built to defend your space as if your race. And of course, finally, this attitude of transforming the Balkans into the place of walls redefines its long-standing metaphor of Balkans as a bridge. Balkans were a bridge in which West and East meet and can exchange their values, pass by, right? That was the whole idea behind the bridge on the Drina River by Ivo Andrić, to show how bridge mediates two worlds, two empires, and that the Balkans were always ones who were in between two worlds. Therefore, their identity is always transient, never fixed. Therefore, they're always in and out at the same time. And we learned how to live with that and understood that actually it is an advantage to be in that kind of fluctuating position, because you can mediate these two opposite empires and two opposite cultures. Now, walls are being built, ironically, among the countries. There used to be countries based on class solidarity and internationalism, right? Former East European socialist type of system, going from the Baltics all the way to the Balkans, that actually these former communist countries are the worst racist nations today. And so you wonder how in the world those who did not have experience of colonialism, who lived for decades in ideology of class solidarity, overnight became racist, right? How, for example, Yugoslav communists overnight became rabid nationalists and are willing to use tactics and strategies common only to colonial conquest and human extermination. Which brings us to the concluding remark, is that actually national borders, division of space, and prohibiting free movement of population is the structural formation of new form of racism in Europe that is the most stronger in the Balkans and in former East European countries. And so in that sense, Balkans are becoming what we like to also call unconscious of Europe. In other words, that everything that Europe suppresses as undesirable reemerges in the Balkans. And then, of course, Europe doesn't recognize that what they're encountering there is their own dark side, leaving up to us to live with this dark side as if only something that belongs to us and to which we are only one who are responsible about. So I'll stop here.
Thank you very much, Dusan. So, and you conceptualize this more as a discussion anyway, so you just gave your remarks, and so let's open the floor for questions.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for a very sweeping and in some ways provocative discussion. So I just have a few of the statements you made strike me as potentially problematic. I just want to ask you your take on them. So first of all, this sort of east to west or west to east dynamic you talked about, where everybody sort of looks to the east as being below them and fear them. I'm not sure that holds up so well if you bring Russia into the picture, for example. And there's a particular relationship between Serbia and Russia. I mean, do Serbians think of Russia as beneath them, as below them, as,
But that's a different East. See, Russia is different East, because all East is not also the same East. Okay. Because there's a difference, there's also term, this guy, Französisch writer, Central European writer, who, when he was asked, where does the Eastern Europe begin? So Eastern Europe is not the same as the Balkans. And he said, Eastern Europe begins there where you see dirty tablecloths, right? That's so that East is different than the Balkan East. Because if you look for, there's a book called Dangerous Zones, was published in 1905. And there's a map of Middle East. Map of Middle East, the border of Middle East is Sarajevo. So the Bosnia, Serbia, Macedonia, Greece, all of that was regarded up to 1905 Middle East, which is very different than Russia.
But not Russia. So it's not a purely geographic dimension.
No, geography, because that is like a Oriental East. Because the here East refers to Orient, where in the case of Russia, East, it's very it's a diff.
Okay, so is there also a north-south element? So I was thinking about, you know, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Poland, Slovenia. I mean, so the Slovenians want to think of themselves, in your account, as Central Europeans.
Yes.
You know, does that mean they think of themselves? Well, how do the Czechs think of the Slovenians? Do the Czechs think of the Slovenians as also the Balkans? Or is...
Well, that's a kind of interesting. I think Czechs, first of all, Slovenes are not really South Slavs, because they are actually part of the groups of Slovaks and Czechs. Is that the Huns or Hungarians, when they come, they split them. So they kind of got stuck with the South Slavs. And their language is very, very different. So there is this alliance between Czechs and Slovenes, see as if they are one. So they are Central Europeans. But then, of course, you have Slovaks and Czechs. Slovaks and Hungarians, right? So you have this micro, because I think Czechs are also Protestant, Slovaks are more Catholics. That's another element. And so you will see that this West-East is more cultural difference. North-South is more economic. So if you look in Yugoslavia, Slovenia was industrial North. Kosovo was agriculture South. So the Slovenia wants to secede from Yugoslavia because they don't want to substitute the South, right? So it's a typical North getting away from class obligation towards the poor working class Albanians or Serbs, you know. So in that sense, in economic sense, you have North-South. But then, of course, that is being mixed with this orientalistic discourse too, because you have wars were fought on many levels: military, economic, psychiatric, cultural, linguistic, on so many different levels. But as a whole, is that you have this economic selfishness combined with civilizational ignorance.
Okay, so I don't want to talk.
But that was also my question, because it seems actually how Yugoslavia was spread out over the Western Balkans was actually along this kind of northeast, northwest to southeast kind of. So
yes.
Maybe that's even like a better, if we want to use another geographic imaginary. You know, I think that's exactly in that article how Žižek actually divides it in between the sort of northwest and southeast.
Because he doesn't make distinction between different easts. Mm-hmm. Just because it's east is not the same. That also has a different reference in a particular location. Because also what you have, and I don't know about Russian and the Balkan states, but you have kind of interesting things, is that when the Balkans wants to be critical of the West, then they reference their Ottoman legacy. Like, so for example, Greeks will say, Turks are this. But when it comes to discussing European masculinity, then they're really more masculine than the Parisians because they have a Turkish genes. So it's kind of, it is, interesting how this East and West, you know, you have this dynamic of East and West constantly shifting depending on the context in which argument is being made. So it's not always that the East is bad. Sometimes we need to use the East in relationship to the West as a kind of Occidentalist type stereotype.
We did have in history in the Avardhan, we had this Micic, this famous surrealist poet, who lived in Paris, who was Serbian, who actually proposed this myth of the Barbaro genius, that the new kind of genius will come from the Balkans, and he, because of the barbaric genes in mixing with the Turks, will be the new Übermensch, the new superior man. In the 20s and 30s, he already proposed this kind of poetic ethnic theory of sorts.
Which is also an example of
this counter,
right? But also identification with the stereotype, which is that if you are calling us barbarians, okay, not only that I'm going to identify myself with, but I'm going to be more barbarians than you can imagine. So there's this counter strategy in which I can be even more stereotyped than you can bear, right? It's a kind of counter strategy to this being made into a stereotype.
So, you know, you also start out talking about the Balkans, the Balkans as a kind of unique setting, but I would say, you know, how are the Balkans different from the Caucasus? The Caucasus, you also have lots of very small, linguistically distinct ethnic groups living side by side, often historically in conflict with one another. You have national boundaries that were imposed artificially by empires and processes of empire. You have growing you have military fights over secession. You have a big northern neighbor with playing a large role in all this. I mean, isn't there, and also if you probably were to talk to a Georgian, they'd say the same thing, where we feel like we're part of the Europe, the Europeans reject us, we want to be part of the EU, the only reason they're keeping us out is because they are prejudiced against us and they don't consider us full-fledged members, is that, you know, and so, you know, how would you respond to that? Is there really a difference between, I mean, we don't have a Caucanized word, but we have Balkanized in English language, which, I mean, that's another.
Yeah.
But, you know, how are the two regions?
Well, I mean, it's, instead of asking question, what is the difference, or is it the same, there's a new there's a something in between, which I would like to use term family resemblance. There's this documentary by Bulgarian anthropologist. She found a song that all of the Balkan countries have, but with different lyrics, and each of them claim that is their song. So she goes around, she goes to Turkey places, Turkey says, oh yeah, that's our song. It's our military song, that they go to Greece. Oh, it's not Turkish, it's our song. And it's different lyrics. And so you see, it's kind of interesting is that the narrative, it's a national inscription. And of course, all narratives vary, because in one country, it's a love song, in other countries, it's like a military song. But it's the same melody. And of course, all different nations enjoy the same melody. So you see, narratives are different, but what combines them together is this, is this melodic a structure in which that's where they're all the same. It's sort of like this is a melody, and here are the narratives of the song, right? So there's this family resemblance. It's like a family picture in which every face is different, but you recognize family in the picture, right? So instead of looking for differences, a kind of analytical difference, we should look more for description of finding family resemblances, right? That they're different, but not that much different, yet they are somewhat different, right? So for example, you know, with Chechens, it's a Russian thing they're dealing, not so much with, as we did with the Germans or Austrians or whatever. So I think it is much more productive to look for this part of the world, to look for the family resemblances that actually Ottoman Empire was all about, because the Ottoman Empire did not have an imperial identity. There was no Ottoman. They are the Serbs, Turks, Armenians, right? In fact, it was very fascinating empire. There was a book out there called Movable Empire that shows how entire empire was based on free migrations. It's empire that benefited from people moving around freely, in which there was no need for imperial identity. and if you look who were the sultans and the rulers, out of 36 of them, only maybe 5 or 6 were Turks. There were Serbs, Armenians, Italians, all kinds of people. So there was this kind of interesting concept in which you can have empire without, which is basically a conglomeration of family resemblances in differences, what they call millet system, coexistence of differences, almost as if like a pattern in weaving, right? And there's a nice description by American writer from 19th century who wrote Moby Dick,
Melville,
right? When he went to Istanbul, he has this wonderful, I recommend everybody to read it, the descriptions, he says, when I look around, you know, they speak all of these languages, it's like a Babylon, all these languages, and everybody understands everybody, how in the world they understand. He went to Bazaar, he says, I just hear all these different languages, but they all understand each other, right? How is this possible? Then he said, and look, they're all over different nations, but they all look alike. So he had this experience of multitude of differences. So when you move into that part of the world, which was mostly a former part of the kind of pre-modern and non-European, it's more useful to use concept of family resemblances than contrasting differences and similarity. I don't know if I make sense, but...
Sure, I mean, you can make a similar argument about the Caucasus regions, that there's a sort of Caucasus, resemblance within there,
and I think it's more productive to speak about that more than you know how we're radically different, right? In fact, you know, humanity is the one, but our history teaching us that there are radical differences, and so there's a problem with the history. Rather than with actual reality, you know.
I mean, after the wars and as a result of the conflict, you know, the politics of creating differences when there are none is a huge machinery, you know, in the new states in the Balkans, you know, to produce new words in the language, you know, to produce new literary traditions, cultural traditions, to excise the neighbors' traditions that are part once the same canon and curriculum like it was in Yugoslavia, so as to create ethnically pure fantasies of a nation state, instead of working with, you know, what he calls family resemblances, like how similar we really are.
So what used to be Serbo-Croat language, which is basically what we call a polycentric language. It means that language, the same language that started with more than one place, is now broken into three languages, right? Four. And so, like when, let's say, Serbian movies shown in Croatia, subtitles are like subtitles that we have on television for people who don't hear. It's still the same. You just have in Croatian script, same words that are people saying.
So people can hear it, but they want to see their alphabet.
That's right. Yeah. But of course, when it comes to swearing, that doesn't change. It's all the same. They all find the same use of swearing. But then when it comes to different words, then they in Croatia, they like to kind of create this Heideggerian language of pure Croatian roots. When Serbia, Serbian language has a lot of Turkish, almost like over 2,000 words are Turkish words. And so that is another example of self-cleansing, is that the Croatian language has to cleanse itself from all of the Serbian Turkish heritage in language, right? Just like in France, you had the cleansing of the old Latin from modern French. So there's on the level of linguistics, you have this political self-purification that, of course, stands for the pure ethnic space.
Could you give us a good example of a curse? Just one.
Oh, God. I'm embarrassed. I can't say because people might understand what I'm saying.
Yes,
They're mostly, they're all like very edible, you know, kind of breaking a taboos. But also a lot of swearing God. God is often object of swear, of a curse, which I think it's basically what used to be a prayer. You know, you pray things to work, and then when you get tired, you just reverse it and just said, fuck it. And that's how it becomes swear.
Well, there is some Turkish importation in Hungarian curse on fene and yemek. What is fene? And then you have in Turkish, I learned fena, that means the bad.
Yeah.
To translate a little bit, so don't speak either.
Well, that's probably you'll find same swears in among the Greeks and Turks. Because it comes just as if you look at food. The food is the same. You know, they like burek, right, or gibanica, or banica, whatever it's called, right? It is the kind of dish that you find in former Ottoman Empire, Middle East as well. So there's this family resemblance on the level of food, right, that we are still integrated on some level, like in our economy of pleasures, if you will, are pretty much the same, even though we have different borders and different passports, but we enjoy the same thing. So, you know, if you come from Balkans and you go some Western town and you see Greek restaurant, you go there. If you see Turkish, you go there, like that, you will find your food there. So there are those family resemblances because we know how this is going to taste. There's a variation. You can put cheese, you can put spinach, you can put whatever this, but it's more or less the same thing.
I think one also other important aspect with the Balkans themselves, at least from my perspective of being there, being somebody who was born and raised in the United States, is still that we have prevalent not only in Western media, textbooks and everything, the blame for the war falls heavily on the Serbs. You can scout through paperwork, everything else, and you're gonna find that the Serbs are like the biggest contributors to this, like we're the only ones who were at war and everything else. And it goes back, I guess, you know, even to First World War, where what the Croatians did doesn't get mentioned. Second World War, what they did doesn't get mentioned. It always falls back to Serbians. So it seems to me, at least as somebody who's an ethnic Serb who was there and who observes what's going on, right now you have this like full-on assault destroying Serbian culture, you know, from within and outside. Hence you have destruction of language, you have destruction of culture, you have separation of land and people, you know, within and whatnot. So, you know, Balkanization indeed, but heavily against the Serbs, because he mentioned, for instance, the massacre or genocide, however you want to call it, of Srebrenica, and that's usually what, you know, media broadcasts, especially Western media. But what everybody fails to mention is that it was United States and United Nations who sanctioned it, supported it, because they supported Radovan Karadzic, and then at the very end they said, oh no, we're not supporting you anymore, because this happened under their watch, and this was their idea in the first place to separate the country and fragment it. And on top of it all, nobody asks, like, well, what created Srebrenica in the first place? Well, nobody mentions that it was the Bosnians or Bosnian Muslims, whatever, who ethnically cleansed over 55 Serbian villages in and around that particular area. Nobody mentions that it was actually the leadership of Clinton who came to Ali Izetbegović, the president of Bosnia at that specific time frame, and told him, it's like, you guys can lose 15, 20, 30, 100 Muslims a day, nobody's going to know, but if, you know, you have a massacre one day that you more than a certain amount of you dies, then the entire world know about it. So actually you have testimony, and this can also be found, for people who were involved where they sit down in a meeting and decide they're going to sacrifice Srebrenica for the sake of their political separation. So those people that got slaughtered over there were pretty much betrayed by their own future state.
Yeah, but it's all tied to creation of a state.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's the tragedy, is that, you know, you have to build something that actually doesn't work. It's like putting a saddle on a Mustang. It won't stay because you have to have a different political organization for that specific location, right? But Europe doesn't recognize, I mean, Yugoslavia was an attempt to create something other than just a nation state. And of course it couldn't survive because the European concept of European Union has to be community of nation states. Therefore Yugoslavia has to be fragmented, and then it's like a corporate takeover. You break it down to the recognizable units and then you integrate them into. But of course, to do that, then you have things like what he says, you have to have a bloodshed and all this, and then of course you have all this mess still unresolved, like in Bosnia. I mean, war actually never stopped there. It's still war going on.
And it's on the verge of breaking out again.
Yeah.
Just like on the very edge now.
And so it's the same thing like United States wanting to establish democracy in Iraq, right? Why don't you recognize that there's a world different than you are, right? And then you have to understand how that world works and then try to adjust and help them to create something that comes out of their own context. Well, that's the problem of the West. West constructs political systems. Build nations, because they, in fact, I think I like that term because it tells you the nation is not something natural, it's something that is being built. There's a work site, it's called war, right, that builds nation. And it works like a bridge, like a building, so like that has to be maintained, and right? But then sometimes it collapses. But it's always underneath requires some form of a civil war, some form of civil tension. And sooner or later, if Europe really wants to become a relevant entity in the world as some kind of avant-garde, has to abandon its national borders. It has to say, like, look, we can organize societies without borders. But of course, that will mean to them as what will mean to us concept of abolishing prisons. Right? It like 13th Amendment originally did not have a clause of those who are in prison can be put to the forced labor. It was just any form of slavery is prohibited in the United States. It means the country without prisons. And for a long time there were no prisons. If you commit a crime, you go to a farm to work. Or you hung. It's basically there were two options, but there were no prisons. The same thing with Europe. You know, you have to come to a point in which you have to realize that national borders do not work. That we live in the world of free movements, and that's why I think Ottoman Empire should be an inspiration and not a condemnation. Because how such a big empire, you know, in which you can from Tehran walk all the way to Marrakesh, nobody will stop you and world didn't fall apart. Why is that not possible today? Right? So this is the ultimate challenge to Europe. Either it's going to be a territory of neo-Nazism that is hiding behind a sovereign space, or is going to be alternative of some kind of free living without borders.
For the original idea of European Union, if you remember, was the Europe of regions, right? That nation states would kind of wither away and the regions that are more organic would come to the fore.
Yeah.
And the other idea was fortress Europe, which is slowly turning into.
Yes, although on like a national borders in which space is becoming a race, and so that the border becomes the fence, actually becomes a skin that recognizes who is in and who is out. So the body is the body of the nation, which is its ethnic space that is marked by the fence.